Welcome to the Depth Dive. Today we're really getting into something fascinating and maybe a bit unsettling. Psychological warfare. Psywar.
Right, and when people hear that, they usually think, you know, secrets, spies, maybe brainwashing. Very covert stuff.
Exactly. Hidden messages, disinformation campaigns. It sounds messy, unpredictable, almost like a dark art.
It really does. But the main source we're digging into today, this foundational work by Paul M.A. Linebarger, he actually pushes back against that idea hard.
Pushes back? How?
Well, he argues Psywar isn't some shadowy guessing game. It's structured. It's analytical. Almost scientific, in a way. And he even makes this really provocative claim.
Which is?
That it's the most humane weapon a military force has.
Humane. Wow. Okay, psychological warfare.
Yeah.
Humane. That sounds like a contradiction. We definitely need to unpack that one.
Absolutely. And to really get it, you have to understand where Linebarger was coming from. This wasn't just theory for him.
He had real-world experience, right?
Oh, yeah. Extensive. The book mentions 9 trips abroad, 5 to the Far East, just after 1949. He was talking to the key players, people like Sir Henry Gurney in Malaya, Colonel Green, who was MacArthur's chief Psywar guy in the Pacific. He saw it in action.
And his background is pretty unique too, isn't it? Something about his father.
That's crucial. His father, Judge Paul M.W. Linebarger, was actually involved in political warfare himself. Deeply involved. Ran campaigns for Sun Yat-sen for the Chinese nationalists.
So he grew up with it in a way.
Exactly. Learned it firsthand. Often on shoestring budgets outside the formal American military structure. This gave him a different perspective. He wasn't just looking at what the U.S. wanted to do. He understood what it felt like to be on the receiving end. You know, to be, as he put it, whipped thoroughly by someone else's propaganda. That's rare insight.
Okay, so here's the plan for this deep dive. We want to figure out what psychological warfare actually is, according to Linebarger and these historical examples. How does it work in practice, both way back when and more recently?
And crucially, where does a democracy like the U.S. draw the line? Or sometimes, where does it fail to draw the line?
Right. We'll use the concepts from the book, the historical story, some pretty surprising details. So by the end, you, our listener, should feel, well, pretty well equipped to spot and analyze the psychological games being played in conflicts and politics today.
Let's get into it. Linebarger starts, logically enough, with definitions, because the definition itself sets up that paradox we mentioned.
The humane weapon paradox.
Right. So in the broad sense, Psywar is just applying psychology to war. Which, when you think about it, covers almost everything militaries do, doesn't it?
Sure. Fear, morale, discipline. It's all psychology.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's too broad to be useful for planning, so he narrows it down. The operational definition, the useful one, is the use of propaganda against an enemy.
Okay, propaganda.
Supplemented by military, economic, or political actions. So it's not just talk. It's talk plus action.
And how does he define propaganda itself?
Simply as organized persuasion by nonviolent means.
Nonviolent. That's the key distinction from, say, bombing a city.
Precisely. Warfare, traditional warfare, is violent persuasion. You burn the city to persuade the enemy to stop fighting. Propaganda aims for the same result, getting the enemy to stop or comply, but without the physical destruction. It's persuasion, not coercion through force alone.
But he points out a big problem here, right? Uncertainty.
A huge problem. Unlike, say, ballistics or logistics, which deal with physical laws and predictable outcomes, Psywar operates in this realm of endless uncertainty. You're targeting the enemy's mind, their will. How do you measure that? How do you guarantee an effect?
It's not like calculating shell trajectory.
Not at all, which is why looking back at history is so important. The basic principles, exploiting uncertainty, creating panic, they haven't really changed. Like the story of Gideon way back in 1245 BCE.
Yes, Gideon and the Midianites. He was massively outnumbered.
Hugely. But his select group of 300 men didn't win by fighting better. They won with psychological shock and awe, basically, using the tech of the day.
The torches and the pitchers.
Right. In that era, seeing a torch or a lantern meant armed men. It was a visual cue. So Gideon had his men hide their torches inside clay pitchers, and he gave them trumpets.
So they approach silently in the dark.
Then on signal, smash, they break the pitchers. Suddenly, 300 points of light flare up. At the same instant, 300 trumpets blast. Imagine the chaos.
It would sound and look like a massive army appearing out of nowhere.
Exactly. The Midianites woke up, utterly confused, probably thought they were surrounded by tens of thousands. They started fighting each other in the panic, and then just fled.
So Linebarger sees this as using unfamiliar instruments, the sudden sound and light, to cause panic, the unexpected element.
That's the key takeaway. Surprise is psychologically devastating. way more than just being outnumbered sometimes.
Okay, so that's a brilliant success. But Cywar can also fail spectacularly, right? Like Wang Mang in China.
Oh, Wang Mang, yes. This is around 23 AD. He was an emperor, a usurper, actually, facing a rebellion. And he had this, well, creative idea.
Creative involving animals, I recall.
A whole menagerie. He gathered tigers, rhinos, elephants from the imperial collection. The plan was to march them towards the rebels. Just scare them into giving up with the sheer weirdness and terror of it all.
How did that work out for him?
Hilariously badly. The rebels weren't scared. They killed the general leading this beastly parade. Then a hurricane hit, apparently, and the animals panicked.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. They stampeded backwards, right into Wang Mang's own army. Trampled them. Total disaster.
Wow. That really shows the flip side. A psyop gone wrong can be catastrophic for the side attempting it.
And Linebarger connects this to a key propaganda theme: depress and unnerve the enemy commander. Wang Mang was so shaken by this failure, he apparently just fell apart. Started eating only oysters, drinking constantly. It broke his morale completely. A comical failure with potentially huge historical consequences.
Then there's Themistocles during the Greco-Persian Wars. A different tactic entirely.
Yes, this is about divisive propaganda. Targeting specific subgroups within the enemy coalition. Themistocles was Greek, fighting the Persians. But there were other Greeks, Ionians, fighting for the Persians.
So he tried to peel them away.
Cleverly, yes. He left inscriptions on stones where the Ionians would find them. But he didn't demand they switch sides immediately. That might be too much to ask.
What did the messages say?
Things like, remember your kinship. Behave ill on purpose. Maybe withdraw from battle or just fight badly. Plant the seed of doubt. Make them question their loyalty to the Persians. It's surgical, aimed at their underlying identity.
And finally, in this historical sweep, we get the Mongols. Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, masters of terror.
Pure psychological intimidation, often before battle was even joined. They used rumor, exaggerated tales of atrocities, and sheer spectacle. Like the story of Kublai Khan's war hatta.
The siege thing on four elephants.
Exactly. Linebarger calls it obviously impractical for field use. It wasn't about function. It was about the story, the image. Creating this myth of overwhelming, unstoppable power. Warfare psychologically waged, as he puts it.
But there's a catch with the Mongol approach, isn't there?
A big one. They were brilliant at breaking the enemy's will to fight. Terrible at consolidation propaganda afterwards. They could conquer, tax, rule by fear. But they rarely won the genuine loyalty of the people they conquered. Unlike, say, cultures that successfully spread their religion or ideology.
So the fear was temporary. It didn't lead to lasting compliance or integration.
Right. And that's a crucial lesson for modern Cywar. It can't just be about immediate shock. It has to consider the long-term goal, which often involves winning hearts and minds, or at least grudging acceptance.
Okay, that distinction between just fear and actual loyalty or belief seems like a good bridge to the principles of modern psychological warfare. Linebarger makes a really big deal about ideology versus opinion.
He does, and it's absolutely fundamental. He argues that so much propaganda fails because it treats wartime allegiance like choosing, you know, a brand of soap. A mere opinion.
When it's actually something much deeper, ideology.
Exactly. Opinion is changeable. Your preference for candidate A over B, or this deodorant over that one. Ideology involves the whole framework of society, your fundamental beliefs about how things should be. And in war, allegiance is almost always ideological.
Why is that distinction so critical for a propagandist?
Because if the conflict is ideological, the stakes are total. The opponents literally cannot feel safe if the other side wins. He uses the example of the religious wars in 17th century Europe, Catholics versus Protestants.
Not just a disagreement about theology.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It was the certainty that if the other side took power, they would use torture, imprisonment, execution, the stake, the rack, to eliminate dissent and secure their own system. Your actual physical safety, your way of life, was on the line.
So you can't just treat the enemy soldier like someone who's merely misinformed about the benefits of your side.
Right. You can't grant freedom or tolerance to those outside your ideological pale if you believe they'll destroy you given the chance. That's why totalitarian states, he mentions Russia, fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, were obsessed with defining orthodoxy and heresy. Ensuring ideological uniformity was paramount. Propaganda has to grapple with that level of commitment.
Which leads to the role of the actual psychologist in Cywar. It's not just about clever slogans.
No, it's highly technical. Linebarger outlines a threefold role. First, and maybe most important, finding out how the enemy really feels.
intelligence gathering, basically?
But specifically psychological intelligence. You can't just guess. You need data. So, using statistics, questionnaires on prisoners of war, if you can get them to build a picture of morale, of attitudes across a whole theater.
If you don't have many prisoners.
Then the next best thing is analyzing the enemy's internal propaganda. What are their leaders telling their own troops, their own people? That tells you what they're worried about, what weaknesses they're trying to shore up, what failures they're trying to explain away. It's a gold mine.
Okay, so first, understand the enemy's mind. What's the second rule?
This one's tough, especially for the creative types often drawn to propaganda. Maintaining mission and proportion.
Meaning?
Meaning the psychologist acts as a brake on the propagandist's own emotions, preventing them from just venting, from indulging in hatred, or what Linebarger calls self-edification, basically, telling the enemy how awful you think they are.
Like, say, American propaganda calling Hitler a demented oaf during the war.
Exactly. Feels good, right? Satisfying. But what does it actually achieve strategically?
Probably just makes the average German soldier angrier, more determined to fight against these crude foreigners insulting their leader and nation.
Precisely. It stiffens resistance. It unites them. The psychologist's job is to keep everyone focused on the only useful mission, making the enemy stop fighting. That's it.
And that requires being cold, objective.
Objective, systematic, cold. You have to suppress the soldier's natural hatred and adopt the cool, calculating mindset of a persuader. What message will actually work to reduce their will to resist?
Okay, so understand the enemy, stay focused on the mission. What's the third role?
The third is really intertwined with the second, ensuring the propaganda is psychologically sound and targeted correctly based on the intelligence gathered. It's about making sure the message fits the medium, the audience, in the objective reality of the enemy situation.
Right. So moving from the role of the psychologist to the actual types of propaganda, Linebarger categorizes them, doesn't he? Based on source.
Yes, this is crucial. The first big distinction is overt or white propaganda. Here, the source is openly acknowledged. Think Voice of America, BBC broadcasting to Germany.
So everyone knows who's talking.
Right. And because the government's reputation is on the line, it has to be generally truthful, dignified, and consistent. You build credibility over time. If the BBC lies today, who's going to believe them tomorrow? It needs to focus on the long game.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the opposite?
Covert or black propaganda. Here, the source is faked or hidden. This is the really cloak and dagger stuff.
Like secret radio stations pretending to be internal resistance groups.
Exactly. Like the Allies running fake German stations during WWII, spreading rumors, defeatism, misinformation, maybe sounding very patriotic, but subtly undermining morale. The OSS pretending Radio Saipan was an internal Japanese station. This requires totally different skills.
How so?
White propaganda needs responsible officials, people mindful of diplomacy and future relations. Black propaganda needs, well, people good at forgery. Illicit imagination, general devilment, as Linebarger puts it. And crucially, people who can keep secrets. He insists you have to keep these operations separate. Mixing them causes chaos.
Okay, so overt white versus covert black based on source. What about timing and purpose?
Two main categories there. Strategic propaganda aims for long-range effects. Months, even years. Maybe warning the German people about the ultimate consequences of Nazi rule, trying to erode support over the long haul.
It's another.
Tactical propaganda. This is immediate short range, like dropping leaflets with surrender instructions right before an attack on a specific enemy unit. Very targeted, very time sensitive.
And then there are more specialized types.
Yeah, he lists a few. Conversionary propaganda, which tries to actually change someone's core allegiance. Mm-hmm. Very difficult. Divisive propaganda, like we saw with Themistocles, trying to split enemy groups. The Allies trying to make German Catholics think of themselves as Catholic first, German second, for example.
Rails.
Consolidation propaganda, which is used in occupied areas to ensure the local population complies. This could be anything from posters showing the occupier strength to mobile movie vans showing newsreels. And finally, counter-propaganda, which is purely defensive, just refuting specific claims made by the enemy, like the U.S. denying Japanese atrocity claims after making similar claims themselves.
So it's quite a complex toolbox.
It is. And choosing the right tool, the right category, the right message, the right medium depends entirely on the specific situation and objective.
Which brings us to the challenges, especially for a democracy like the U.S. Linebarger argues that a total psychological warfare system, one controlling everything, is just impossible here, right? Constitutionally impossible.
Fundamentally impossible. You'd need dictatorial control over all media, all public opinion. Can't happen in the U.S. And this creates inherent limitations, big ones. He breaks them down into political, security, media, and personnel.
Let's start with the political limitations. These seem the most fundamental.
They are, because democratic Psywar has to serve the ultimate political goal, ending the war successfully, with minimum cost, and in a way that allows for a stable peace afterwards. But what plays well with the public at home often directly undermines that goal abroad.
The example of the Japanese emperor during World War II comes to mind.
Perfect example. Domestically, there was huge pressure in the U.S. to vilify the emperor, call him names, you know, really let loose. It would have felt satisfying.
But the strategic effect?
Disastrous. It would have instantly united the Japanese people against the U.S. More importantly, the emperor was the one figure who could ultimately order the surrender. If U.S. propaganda destroyed his legitimacy among his own people, that crucial tool for ending the war peacefully would have been lost. It could have meant prolonging the war, maybe even necessitating a full-scale invasion.
So the political reality demanded restraint. Even if it felt unsatisfying at home, it had to be strategically cold.
Exactly. And related to this is the problem of conflicting promises.
How does that work?
Well, official U.S. policy often has to be cautious, maybe vague about post-war arrangements. But then you have individual agents in the field, or sometimes even allied leaders, making specific, often contradictory promises to different groups.
Like promising independence to one group and continued colonial rule supported by another.
Precisely. Linebarger mentions examples like implying a homeland for the Dutch in Indonesia, while also promising self-government to the Indonesians and promising resource access to the Japanese. You can't keep all those promises.
And the danger.
The danger is that if some lower-level Psywar officer makes a promise that isn't backed up right from the top, the president, the cabinet, the entire nation gets branded a liar when the promise isn't kept. He gives the example of conflicting messages given to Chinese communists and nationalists simultaneously. Everyone found out, and U.S. credibility plummeted with both sides.
Okay, so political constraints are huge. What about the security paradox?
This is a classic bureaucratic catch-22. The intelligence and security folks, their instinct is to classify everything. Keep information tight, withhold troop numbers, hide casualty figures, keep plans secret.
But propaganda needs information to be effective.
Exactly. To be credible, especially white propaganda, you need timely, accurate information. You need to be able to refute enemy claims with facts. You need to release some real data to make your message believable. So the goals of security withhold information are directly opposed to the goals of propaganda disseminate information.
And this apparently led to utter chaos during World War II in the U.S.
Oh, unbelievable chaos. You had this alphabet soup of agencies popping up, COI, FIS, SSG, OWI, OSS, all overlapping, all fighting for turf, personnel, budget. Linebarger says this internal bureaucratic struggle lasted almost 2 years and was often a bigger headache than the actual enemy.
He has some incredible anecdotes about this.
He really does. Like highly classified strategic plans from the Joint Chiefs being locked away. Not from the Germans or Japanese, but from the American propaganda writers.
Why?
Because security was afraid the writers would break security on them by obeying and applying them. Think about that. The operational plan couldn't be used for its intended psychological effect because secrecy trumped effectiveness.
And the story about the classified plan in the desk drawer.
Oh, that's a classic. He says he found a top-secret inter-allied plan just left in a desk drawer in Washington by an elderly stenographer.
Unbelievable.
And the punchline, the drawer didn't even have a pull handle. That was apparently the security measure. It just shows the level of paranoia mixed with, well, sheer incompetence sometimes.
And agencies refusing to share information, even with each other.
Yes. New York or San Francisco OWI offices refusing to let Washington HQ see what they were broadcasting, citing their own security concerns against their bosses. He had to get reports on U.S. broadcasts from Navy submarines, monitoring them in the Pacific, just to find out what his own organization was doing.
It sounds like a miracle anything got done.
Linebarger suggests the only reason it didn't completely collapse was this sort of common denominator of American culture, a general goodwill and ability to muddle through. Someone from a more rigid hierarchical system like Germany or Japan would have gone insane in that environment.
Okay, so political limits, security nightmares, then there were basic media and personnel missteps.
Yeah, violating really basic rules. The number one rule being, design your propaganda to affect the people who can actually receive it.
Like the example of shortwave radio broadcasts to Japan.
Exactly. OWI was beaming these sophisticated programs, soap operas, music, news, aimed at the Japanese masses. The problem? Intelligence showed that almost nobody but government officials and the very wealthy in Japan actually had shortwave radios.
So they were broadcasting messages for the average person to an audience of elites and government censors.
Complete mismatch. Pointless effort. Same as dropping books on populations that were largely illiterate.
Yeah.
The medium has to reach the target audience. Seems obvious, but it was often overlooked.
And the personnel issue with language and accents, that was interesting.
Very nuanced. The basic rule he lays out for foreign language broadcasts is the speaker's accent must either be authentically perfect for the target audience.
Like a native speaker.
Or they should make no effort to hide their foreign accent. Be clearly foreign.
Why not try for something in between? A good but not perfect accent.
Because that middle ground can sound suspicious. Is this person trying to trick me? Who are they really? The British actually found something counterintuitive with their German broadcasts.
What was that?
They discovered their broadcasts were often more credible, more trusted, when the announcer spoke German with a clear, obvious British accent.
Really? Why?
Because the German listener thought, okay, this is clearly the enemy speaking. It's a genuine Britisher. I know where this is coming from. It signaled authenticity, ironically. It marked it clearly as white propaganda. A perfect German accent might have made them suspect it was black propaganda, some kind of trick, and they tune out.
Fascinating. The foreignness became a sign of honesty.
In that specific context, yes. It underlines how sensitive Cywar is to perception and audience expectation.
Okay, so we've covered the definitions, history, principles, and the very real limitations. Let's shift to the tools propagandists use when things are working systematically. Leinbarger introduces the STASM formula, STASM.
Right. This is his framework for analyzing any piece of propaganda. Mm-hmm. It forces you to break it down systematically, avoid just reacting emotionally. STASMM stands for source, time, audience, subject, mission.
Let's walk through that. Source.
You have to ask, who really produced this? The true source. And who do they pretend is producing it? The ostensible source. Spotting the difference is key to identifying black propaganda.
Okay. Time.
When was it disseminated? Is it tied to a specific event? Is it tactical or strategic in its timing?
Audience. We touched on this, but it's complex.
Very. You need to identify the intended direct audience. Example, people in France. The intended indirect audience, for example, French speakers in Canada who might pick it up. And the unintended audience, or JG and enemy intelligence agency, analyzing it. The message might have different effects on each.
Right. Then subject, what's it actually about?
This is where propaganda analysis becomes really valuable for general intelligence. You look at what the enemy is talking about, and just as importantly, what they're not talking about. What are themes do they keep repeating? What subjects do they avoid?
He had that great example about the Japanese fish catch reports.
Yes. If Japanese propaganda suddenly started boasting about a huge fish catch,
you might think, oh, their fishing fleet is doing well.
Right. But the analyst, using Steelos, might realize this boast coincides with other intel suggesting fuel shortages. So the boast isn't about a good catch. It's likely covering up a bad catch caused by lack of fuel. It's internal counter-propaganda designed to boost morale, but it inadvertently signals a logistical weakness to the enemy analyst.
Clever, turning their own message against them. And finally, mission.
What is this piece of propaganda actually trying to achieve? Is it trying to lower morale? Incite defection, justify a past action, confuse the enemy. You need to define the specific operational goal.
So SALSM provides a really rigorous way to dissect any message. Let's apply this thinking to troop propaganda, aiming messages directly at enemy soldiers in the field. What's the goal there?
It's usually subtle. The primary goal often isn't to get soldiers to actively desert or surrender on their own initiative. That carries a huge psychological burden, treason, shame.
So what is the goal?
It's more about inducing eventual capture. Making capture seem acceptable, even inevitable, when the situation gets bad enough. Planting the idea that survival is the truest form of loyalty to family, maybe even country in the long run. You want them to comply when capture becomes imminent, not fight to the last man.
Leinbarger outlines specific steps for effective tactical troop propaganda.
He does. First, establish the idea that surrender is happening, that it's inevitable. Cite specific units that have already given up, using facts they might be able to verify. Make it seem normal, almost expected.
Okay, normalize surrender.
Second, introduce themes suggesting further resistance is pointless. Connect their small tactical struggle to the larger strategic picture, which might look hopeless. Why die for a lost cause? Undermine their sense of purpose.
Makes sense.
Third, link the next predictable bad situation, maybe an upcoming encirclement, running out of ammo or food, link that specific situation to the general idea of hopelessness. Prime them to see the next crisis as the breaking point.
And the final step is very practical.
Very. give concrete, specific instructions for how to surrender safely, and often appeal to basic human needs, like those World War I leaflets aimed at starving German soldiers.
The ones listing food items.
Exactly. Not just surrender and get food, but specific, mouth-watering items. Beef, white bread, potatoes, beans, plums, genuine bean coffee. For men on watery soup, the concrete image of that meal could be incredibly powerful, almost obsessive.
That really highlights the psychological element. It leads nicely into that innovative tactic used on Okinawa, the loudspeaker tanks.
Ah, yes, that was brilliant. The situation was grim. Japanese soldiers were dug into caves, fighting desperately. Clearing them out was incredibly costly for the Americans.
And direct appeals weren't working well.
No. Language barriers were a problem, American accents were instantly recognized, and the Japanese soldiers were terrified of surrendering directly to an armed American soldier.
So the solution?
Mount powerful loudspeakers on tanks. But crucially, connect those loudspeakers via radio telephone back to headquarters miles away.
Why headquarters?
Because that's where they stationed American-born Japanese speakers, Nisei soldiers, men who spoke colloquial Japanese, but who had been specifically trained to lose their American accents for this purpose.
Ah, so the voice sounded authentic, familiar.
Exactly. The tank commander near the cave would radio back the situation. Got 5 holes in the hillside here, 2 trees on the crest. Then the Nisei speaker back at HQ, hearing this, would craft a personalized, immediate appeal.
And broadcast it through the tank's loudspeaker.
Right into the cave entrances. Talking them out, addressing their fears, giving specific instructions, it bypassed the accent problem, the immediate fear factor. It was incredibly effective at coaxing surrender without direct confrontation. Fantastic example of tactical Psywar innovation.
Okay, so moving beyond World War II now into the Cold War era, Leinbarger sees a major shift with the rise of communism.
A fundamental shift.
Yeah.
He calls the communist strategy permanent psychological warfare in action. It wasn't just a wartime tool for them. It was a constant, ongoing ideological struggle.
What made it different?
Their starting point, fanatical certainty. They believed Marxism provided an inevitable scientific prediction of history. Their revolution was going to succeed. This gave them, in their view, the right, even the duty, to undermine and sabotage all other systems by any means necessary. No moral qualms about it.
So their propaganda was relentless.
Relentless, dynamic, global, often clandestine and highly adaptable. It forced the West, particularly the U.S., to keep Psywar capabilities active even in peacetime, just to counter the constant communist ideological offensive.
And this commitment led to some extreme techniques, like brainwashing.
Yes, particularly as practiced by the Chinese communists. Leinbarger describes it not as persuasion, but as a direct assault on the individual's personality.
How'd it work?
Through a combination of induced fatigue, relentless interrogation, intense group pressure, confession, criticism, driving the person toward a complete mental and emotional breakdown. The goal was to shatter the old bourgeois self and then systematically rebuild them, indoctrinate them into the new communist normality, making them genuinely believe and conform. It's terrifyingly invasive.
He shares a really disturbing anecdote about this. A Catholic who was successfully brainwashed?
Yes. Completely converted, became a functioning, seemingly convinced communist, totally adjusted by all appearances.
That wasn't stable.
Not fundamentally. The story goes he eventually had a complete schizophrenic break, triggered, apparently, by underlying personal issue sexual frustrations. The text hints that the new communist persona couldn't integrate or resolve.
And the break was sudden?
Instantaneous. He was walking down Nanking Road in Shanghai and bam. In a fraction of a second, he realized he was anti-communist again, surrounded by enemies. Leinbarger uses the phrase, he went crazy enough to come back to our side.
Wow. That really shows the fragility, perhaps, of that kind of forced conversion. It might work on the surface, but the underlying person is still there, maybe suppressed.
It suggests that kind of imposed normality is inherently unstable, vulnerable to collapsing under stress. It relies on constant external pressure and suppression.
So facing this kind of relentless, fanatical opponent in the Cold War, how could the U.S. possibly compete psychologically, given all the limitations we discussed, the constitutional constraints, the need for openness?
That's the American paradox Leinbarger highlights. He's very clear. The U.S. not now capable and, under the spirit of the Constitution, can never be capable of surprising an enemy by the timing of aggression. We can't run a Hitler-style war of nerves, building tension, keeping everyone guessing.
Why enter?
Because our system doesn't allow it. Commentators would speculate. Legislators would demand answers. Someone inside the planning agency would probably leak the top secret schedule to the press. We'd end up, as he says, amusing the enemy we meant to scare.
So, if the communist strengths were fanaticism, certainty, revolutionary zeal, what did Leinbarger see as the American strengths in this psychological battle?
He identifies them as the strengths of living as opposed to the strengths of revolution. Things like sobriety, calmness, health, and maybe most importantly, flexibility.
Flexibility, how so?
A tolerance for dissent, for individuality, the lack of a rigid state-mandated party line. The U.S. wasn't on a crusade like the communists were. It relied more on its inherent stability and, well, normalcy.
Which leads to maybe the funniest story in the whole book. The Korea voice plane incident.
Oh, it's priceless. And it perfectly illustrates this American tolerance. You have U.S. Reserve Sergeant flying a loudspeaker plane low over American headquarters in Korea during the war. He's supposed to be testing the equipment.
Just doing a sound check. Testing. 1, 2, 3.
Right. But this sergeant is apparently fed up, wants to go home, maybe he's feeling a bit rebellious.
What does he broadcast?
Instead of testing, his voice booms out over the entire headquarters loud and clear.
Why don't you imperialist sons of bitches go back to Wall Street where you belong?
Oh my goodness. Over friendly lines.
Over friendly lines. Directed at his own side's command structure. What happened to him? Court martial.
Nothing. That's the punchline. He wasn't punished. And Leinbarger says that tolerance, that ability to just shrug off that kind of internal dissent, was the uniquely American part. Americans often thought their enemies were funny or silly, he writes. This lack of rigid ideological conformity was completely baffling, inscrutable to the Koreans and communists.
So our perceived weakness, lack of total control, allowing for dissent, might actually be a kind of psychological strength.
That's his argument, this mild irresponsibility, this emotional health, this belief that I ain't mad at nobody, as he puts it. It represents a different kind of strength. A resilience based on living, not just on revolution. Maybe better suited for the long haul.
Wow. Okay, this deep dive has certainly shifted my perspective on psychological warfare. It's far from just shadowy spies. It's structured, analytical, rooted in history, and full of these incredible paradoxes.
Absolutely. We've seen how tactics from Gideon thousands of years ago still have relevance. How modern psy war grapples with deep ideological commitment, not just surface opinions.
And the sheer administrative chaos the U.S. faced in WWII trying to run these operations, agencies fighting each other, plans locked away from the people supposed to use them, that image of the desk drawer with no handle really sticks with you.
It does. It highlights the immense challenge of conducting effective psy war within a democratic framework with all its built-in checks, balances, and, frankly, inefficiencies.
But we have to come back to that central, provocative claim from Leinbarger that psy war is ultimately the most humane military weapon.
Because its core mission, when done right, isn't to kill or destroy. It's to persuade the enemy to stop fighting, to choose surrender, compliance, or even friendship over annihilation. In that sense, its goal is inherently life-saving for both sides.
So for you, the listener, we hope this exploration gives you some tools. Thinking about that SANSM framework source, time, audience, subject, mission, whenever you encounter persuasive messages, especially in conflict or political situations, it's a way to see past the surface, understand the mechanics, and shield yourself a bit from manipulation.
And maybe we could leave you with this final thought to chew on, building on Leinbarger's insights. In today's world, when you see conflicts between systems driven by absolute certainty, maybe even fanaticism, and democratic systems that value flexibility, dissent, even that mild irresponsibility, which approach holds long-term strategic advantage? Can that democratic composure, that refusal to get locked into a rigid crusade, that belief that maybe the enemy is just funny or silly, can that ultimately be the more resilient, the more inscrutable, and perhaps the stronger psychological position? That's a question worth pondering.